country has long been a pioneer. We inaugurated the steam age, we inaugurated the atomic age, the age of the genome. Every one of those ideas was controversial. Every one of them was difficult. But we always had the courage as a country to be original, to do things differently.
Today on Vox Talks, British inventive genius, myth or reality? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Why will the British benefit from Brexit, cope with COVID, and how did they win World War II? The argument you often hear from us Brits is that our country's go-it-alone scientific and inventive genius means we can overcome challenges that other nations could not. Well, this week, VoxEU publishes its ebook on the economic history of the Second World War. And today, on the 75th anniversary of the Allied victory in Europe, I'm talking to an economic historian and one of the authors in our ebook who argues that this populist historical narrative of Britishness is, in his words, deluded and a cynical fantasy. David Edgerton, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thank you very much.
You point out that this story of British inventive, creative genius is a common thread in the UK government's reaction to COVID-19 and Brexit as well. Can you give me examples of this?
Well, yes, it really is central to Brexit. Not just Boris Johnson, but Theresa May herself insisted that one of the key points in favour of Brexit was that the UK was a uniquely creative place in the world. And Theresa May, standing underneath the 1950s Jodrell Bank radio telescope, said that the UK would lead the world into the fourth industrial revolution, just as it had led it into the first. And if you look at the speeches of the Brexiteers, they're absolutely packed with references to British inventive genius, to biosciences, to battery technology, all sorts of different things. And the key argument that they want to make is that the UK can be a major innovation hub. It needs to be outside of the single market to create its own technological regulations. And if it does that, it will be able to have a massive role in the future world economy. It's not merely talking the UK up. I think it is an argument they really believe in. For example, you don't have to worry about the car industry or any existing industry. What you've got to focus your attention on is the future, and that future is going to come from the supposedly unique British inventiveness.
And this has a long history, doesn't it? As you point out, it's also been part of the accepted historical narrative that we tell about World War II, for example, in things like the development of the Spitfire fighter aircraft.
Yes, that's right. But there is some truth to the historical story. It's certainly the case that, for example, in the case of COVID, the British government has insisted that we can develop emergency ventilators in the same way that in the beginning of the Second World War, we developed Spitfire and radar and so on. So the idea is that you are in a position where you have to invent your way out of a crisis. Now, that is a thoroughly misleading account of World War II. Spitfires were being built from 1938. They weren't magicked out of thin air in 1940. They were pouring off the production lines. The factories had long been built, massive factories. So the British were actually prepared for World War II. They were prepared technologically. They were prepared industrially as well.
Because you wrote that in 1940, I quote it for you here, neither the UK nor the British Empire was either alone or weak, as post-war historians would later claim. And historians have claimed this, and it has become the accepted narrative. And how did that happen?
The question of weakness in 1940 is a central tenet of what I call the declinist historiography of the United Kingdom. And it argues essentially that the liberalism of the late 19th century and the early 20th century undermined British inventive capacity, undermined its industrial capacity, and indeed undermined its willingness to fight. And that is why in 1940 it found itself weak and was, as a result, defeated in France. The other argument is that it was alone, that something called Britain was alone. And this argument was actually not an argument that came from the war itself. It arose, in fact, from 1945. Winston Churchill pushed it very hard. He did not use the argument in 1940 or 1941. And historians took it up really from the 1960s. So it's only then that you get book after book saying Britain stood alone in 1940. And when historians were talking about Britain in that case, they were talking about the United Kingdom, the island nation. They were not talking about the empire. The empire was taken out of the story. In the more recent past, historians have put the empire in, that even in 1940-41, the British Empire was not alone. It was fighting with forces from Poland, from France. It was fighting alongside the Greeks. The great merchant marines of Europe had come over to the United Kingdom as well. The great colonial territories of the Dutch and the Belgians were allied with the British Empire. And of course, the United States was also helping. British propaganda insisted first on the unity of the British Empire and secondly on the fact that this empire had allies.
This version of history implies that the British coped with the industrial challenge of the war by looking inward. Was the UK's war economy that isolated?
Exactly so. What we have after the war is essentially a kind of nationalist historiography and a historiography which criticised pre-war imperialism and pre-war liberalism for weakening the nation. So within that frame, the British war economy succeeded in World War II because it turned inward. This is to misunderstand the fundamental nature of the UK's war economy. It was a radically global war economy. It continued to import on a massive scale. In fact, in 1943-44, the scale of imports in terms of value was greater than before the war. Now, this was partly huge quantities of food and other supplies came from the River Plate, from parts of the British Empire as well. Now, one of the common arguments for the view that the economy nationalised is the fact that the UK depended on food imports before the war, that these food imports halved during the war. Mm. That's a gross exaggeration because half of that halving was the removal of imports of feed for animals.
Ah.
Human food imports only fell by about a quarter. But some food imports actually increased over the course of the war. Two very pertinent examples are meat and cheese. It's hard to believe, actually, that during the war, the United Kingdom actually both reduced its consumption of meat and further globalized its meat supplies. Now, why did it do this? Well, because the key constraint was import capacity. So instead of importing kind of bulky maize to feed animals, as it happened before the war, you now imported frozen meat or canned meat. So that's on the food side. Food imports allowed British workers to stay off the land and to go into arms factories and to go into the armed forces. The United Kingdom was supplied with petroleum products from the rest of the world, so it didn't have to use coal very inefficiently to make petrol in the way the Germans did. So my argument is that Britain was so strongly mobilized in World War II, both because it was a very efficient economy at height, but also because it maintained its quite distinctive global supply arrangements. I mean, what changed actually is where the supplies came from. One example, bacon couldn't come from Denmark anymore, so it came from North America, or indeed was replaced by Spam.
Yes, of course. But David, are we not rejecting some of the really big successes of British wartime creativity? You already mentioned radar. We had the Enigma codebreakers that eventually led to the invention of the computer. Don't the Brits have a pretty good record for big projects during wartime?
That's absolutely right. And my argument here is that the British military-industrial complex has been strong for a very, very long time. And on top of that, the British state has invested in technological, scientific ways of warfare to avoid having to create mass armies. The idea that you should develop new technologies for warfighting is deeply ingrained in the practices of the British state. Radar and code breaking are examples. But we shouldn't confuse the development of radar and code breaking with British inventiveness. Radar was not a uniquely British invention, far from it.
Ah.
I mean, pretty well every power had radar equipment even before the war. The British were particularly good at developing it, of creating a system to use radar. The case of Enigma, the method for breaking the Enigma codes came from Polish cryptographers. And if you look at television, the United Kingdom is the first country to have a large-scale public television service. But it's pretty hard to argue that the television system, the dominant one that was used, was a British invention. It wasn't. It was adopted by the British.
And you make the argument also that this talk of big ideas as solutions for big problems often disguises broader policy in action. And I think this is where your cynical fantasy description comes from. So I would be implying that this is done on purpose to distract the public, or is it just incompetence in policymaking?
I think the examples I'm referring to are very clever moves on the part of government to avoid policies that they think are wrong. In the Edwardian years, there was a great push from the Conservatives for protection of industry and protection of British agriculture. That the Liberals thought both these policies would be a disaster and wanted to avoid them. And in the case of agriculture, one way of doing that was to promote agricultural research, to argue that we're putting money into research and that will make the lives of British farmers easier so they won't need protection. In the interwar years, something called the Empire Marketing Board supported research directed at promoting imperial trade, again, as an alternative to protectionism. It seems to me a very clever thing to do. This is a developed form of masterly inactivity.
Can we say that this narrative of inventive genius overall has had a negative impact on the UK economy? Is the economy smaller than it otherwise would have been because this has been such a successful story to tell?
I think so. I think there's an argument to be made that after the Second World War, the UK overinvested in R&D. I'm very aware that a lot of people will think I'm barking mad in saying that.
That's a very unusual thing to say.
I've been saying it for some decades now, and the counter argument hasn't shown its face as yet. In the 1960s, British economists were pretty clear that one shouldn't expect there to be a positive correlation between national investment in research and development and national rates of economic growth. As indeed there weren't, and indeed there aren't today for very good economic reasons. But to answer your question more directly, I think it's very easy to argue that particular kinds of overinvestment in R&D made the United Kingdom poorer. Two celebrated examples discussed by the economist David Henderson in the 1970s, Concorde and the Advanced Gas Cooled Reactor. He was certainly right to suggest that British people are poorer as a result of those investments. And both were predicated on a notion of a special British genius.
So let's look to the future, because right now the UK government has two enormous sets of important policy decisions to make. First, how it's going to recover from COVID-19. Second, of course, how it concludes its Brexit negotiations. Are some of the current ideas that you hear the same kind of delusions that you referred to at the beginning?
Yes, there was a response to COVID-19 which relied on a notion of British exceptionalism, of the peculiar ability of British scientists to see the reality of COVID-19, which is not available to others. I think this was well expressed in Boris Johnson's 3rd February speech, just a few days after Brexit, in which he claimed that Britain could take advantage of COVID-19 in that it would lead to countries blocking off trade with each other, and the British, as global champions of free trade, could continue trading and basically clean up. There's also great insistence, and it's still there, on British genius in vaccine research. In the case of Brexit, one of the most interesting things is the idea that Brexit will make all the difference in the world, but also that trading on WTO rules won't make much difference, really. That's to say that we don't actually gain anything, it seems, from the apparatus of the single market. There seems to be this belief in British government that no deal Brexit will have minimal economic consequences. And I think this is an important reason for the lack of preparation for that no deal Brexit. Because if you really believe that being in or out of the EU made a huge difference, you'd be getting your businesses ready, you're getting your people ready, you're getting your customs infrastructure ready. But that's essentially not happening. It's really rather interesting. But I think things have changed. I think in the case of COVID-19, the British government has in fact followed the practices first of continental Europe, and is about to embark on copying the practices of many Asian countries. It is now talking about global programs for vaccine development. We shall see where this leads in the case of Brexit. A reality there is about to hit in the way that it's already hit with COVID-19. But I'm bound to say that this image of an exceptional Britain has done enormous amount of damage to the British economy and to lives of British people, both through the weak response to COVID-19 and the refusal to face reality over Brexit. I mustn't be misunderstood. I think the British economy is today really quite unexceptional. But it was exceptional at the beginning of the 20th century, indeed right up into the middle of the 20th century. It was exceptional in its openness to the world. And I think much success at that time came from precisely that openness. But we're in a very, very, very different place today. So in effect, we have Edwardian delusions of power. In the Edwardian times, there were delusions of power, but they were nowhere near as deluded as the transplanted versions are.
So because part of that narrative that we're seeing on how we cope with both of these policy challenges does rely very much on recapturing that Victorian Edwardian spirit, you're saying this is not really good policy advice at the moment.
It is terrible policy advice. I think we need to recognise that the UK economy is much like the French economy. The levels of income per head in the UK per hour worked are lower than in continental Europe. The research and development expenditures are certainly not the highest in Europe. What we need actually is a politics of imitation, not the kind of politics of innovation that we have.
A little bit more imitation, less emphasis on innovation. I would imagine that people will have strong views on this, so let us know if you do. Meanwhile, David, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
If you want to read up on this argument, I think you probably do, read David's contribution to our ebook. That's a free download from VoxEU, and the book's title is The Economics of the Second World War, 75 Years On. There are a lot of very interesting contributions. David's is one of them. Editors are Stephen Broadberry and Mark Harrison. David's chapter is called Never Alone, Always Strong, The British War Economy in 1940 and After. And if you want to read more that David's written on British responses to COVID-19 in relation to the Second World War and also to Brexit, you'll find contributions from The New European, The New Statesman and The Guardian through his blog, which is davidegerton.org. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks and you will never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.